From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the latest on the fiscal cliff negotiations in Washington. What's the word from Michigan's delegation on Capitol Hill?
There's two ironclad rules of budget negotiations in Washington. One is you don't have to get a deal until you have to, and number two, oftentimes you don't get a deal until something craters.
Plus, just why were police and fire unions in Michigan left out of right to work?
Some claim it was practical, some claim it was political, and there's a bit of controversy about it.
And we take a closer look at what it takes to be a firefighter.
We just like helping people out. It's in your blood. Once you're a fireman, it's just in there, and that's why you do your job.
We talk with two of the firefighters featured in the new documentary film, Burn. All of that and much more on today's show. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, fiscal cliff bargaining continues on Capitol Hill. We'll get an update from D.C. on what the negotiations mean for us here in Michigan. Also, when Right to Work was passed last week in Lansing, it exempted police officers and firefighters. We'll find out why. But first, big news out of the auto industry today. It's been announced that General Motors will buy back about 200 million shares of its stock from the federal government. It'll cost the company about $5.5 billion. The U.S. got those shares as part of an almost $50 billion bailout of GM that began almost 4 years ago when the automaker was on the verge of collapse. Sonari Glinton is business reporter for NPR. He joins us now. Sonari, put this all into context for us. What does it mean?
Well, it means separate things for the government and for General Motors. When the government gave this money to GM, it came with strings, and so those strings get cut. You know, things like executive compensation, there are limits on that. There's also sort of a layer of bureaucracy that comes with having the government in charge. Even though, you know, GM executives would say, you know, the government hasn't had a real hand in things, but they still have, you know, there's this cultural thing. I mean, we just came through a campaign where the auto industry was front and center in this campaign.
Even though it didn't want to be.
Yeah. Oh, it didn't want to be. When you talk to an executive, you could hear them exhaling. You could hear them like, oh, really? I have to deal with this. You can't, you know, the Chevy Volt was a victim.
Yeah.
The government Motors moniker goes away. And that's really important to be able to focus on what this company hasn't been really doing best, but will be, which is sell cars.
Mm-hmm. So why now?
Well, you know, it's interesting that Mitt Romney during the campaign said that he would sell back GM immediately.
He did.
Yeah. And on first day one. And so the president is, you know, not doing it on day one. He's doing it negative day 20.
right.
The government doesn't want to be in private business. The government doesn't want, the administration doesn't want to be, have this focus. And it's also a part of what's going on is that it's a part of TARP. And since the bailout was a part of TARP, the government wants to get that off of its back.
It's got bigger fish to fry right now, in a sense, too.
Yes, exactly. And
really, what would you say this means, Sonari, for General Motors employees and all those supply companies whose lives depend on parts to General Motors and General Motors staying healthy?
You know, when I talk to people at General Motors, they always say this thing where the reporter in you is kind of skeptical. They're like, mm-hmm. we're thankful to the government for stepping in and doing this. And every single time they talk about that, and you go, yeah, they have to say that. But there is this sense that workers and executives are genuinely thankful for the help to keep this industry alive, to keep this important company alive. But as I was saying to an executive, it's kind of like when you get your first paycheck and you're out on your own, mm-hmm. you're thankful for your parents for helping you out, but you're glad to be able to be on your own. And that is the real sense that I get. General Motors has to stand on its own. And you know what? There is not political will to do this again.
So, Sonari, what comes next? Government still owns stake in General Motors, right?
Yes, it does. It has about 300 million outstanding shares. So GM's going to buy back 200 million mm-hmm. of those shares. And over the next year, the government is going to sell off the rest of those shares in a variety, it says, in a variety of means. It's a part of winding down TARP. The hope is that it won't lose as much money as the stock price increases, as things get better for GM. But right now, if all the shares are sold right now, the government would lose about $21 billion. So they're hoping to meet that out over time. And so they won't be, you won't wake up one morning and like 300 million shares of GM stock is going to be on the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay.
But it'll be meted out over the next 15 months.
Sonari Glinton, business reporter for NPR. Thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you so much.
And in other General Motors news, the automaker announced today it's going to move production of the Camaro from its Canadian plant operation in Ontario to Michigan. The shift to the Lansing Grand River plant is likely to happen in the next few years. To Washington now, where, behind closed doors, bargaining over the nation's fiscal cliff is reportedly at a tipping point, so close to coming together and so close to falling apart. House Speaker John Boehner yesterday unveiled his so-called Plan B that would raise taxes on those making over $1 million, but keep them status quo for everyone else. This came after President Obama budged a little on the fiscal cliff bargaining, moving the income marker up to $400,000. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is following all the action today in Washington. He joins us now. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the proverbial clock is ticking. We're less than 2 weeks away from taking that tumble over the fiscal cliff if there's no compromise. And you're talking with Michigan's congressional delegation, and a lot of us may not realize it. They really have – Michigan's got a big role in all of this.
Huge. I mean, Michigan has three committee chairmen who chair the probably arguably the three most powerful committees in Congress, Fred Upton at Energy and Commerce, Dave Camp at Ways and Means, the Chief Tax Writing Committee, and of course, Mike Rogers, who chairs the Intelligence Committee. So Michigan Republicans particularly play a big role in this House of Representatives and will for the next 2 years.
Especially if you're talking with Dave Camp and Ways and Means, as we're kind of focusing on that. What are you hearing from them as far as the status of the talks?
I think that their feeling is it's not as optimistic, at least near term, as some of the reports would suggest. There's a feeling, I think, among the Republicans that the White House hasn't moved that much and that they're moving more on taxes and in a sense kind of going back to some plans that have already been floated in the last time we went around this bend back in 2011. So I think they feel there's still some more to go. And when I talked with Congressman Camp this morning, he acknowledged that, you know, these deals don't get done until they have to get done. And the truth of the matter is this does not have to get done before Christmas. Therefore, the likelihood is that it probably won't. There will be some votes later this week on both Boehner's Plan B and as well as something in the Senate. I don't think anybody thinks that necessarily these things are going to materially move the ball forward.
And there seems to be dissension in the Republican ranks, with a lot of Republican representatives saying we're not voting for this, so that Plan B doesn't have
exactly
a lot of support, correct?
Exactly. And I think what's different this time is the Speaker has, I think the party within his party, within Congress, is a little bit more behind him than they were in 2011 when there was kind of open warfare between him and the Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, out of Virginia. They seem to have patched that up. They're now all on the same team and trying to get something done here. But it's been tough sledding with the White House, which is coming off of a very big win, is trying to interpret that as, you know, kind of our way or the highway. And so that's kind of where they are at this point.
Dan, we've had economics and finance experts on stateside say that even if we do go over that so-called cliff, the world will not end on January 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take and what are you hearing from Michigan's lawmakers?
Well, I think there's a sense that that is probably true. I mean, you know, these tax increases don't come immediately. They do maybe from week to week and month to month, but you're not going to feel that bite until a little bit further down the road. So, and in fact, you know, as I've talked with some people here and people have reminded me, there's two ironclad rules of budget negotiations in Washington. One is you don't get a deal until you have to, and number two, oftentimes you don't get a deal until something craters. And cratering is, in this context, might be going over the fiscal cliff. It might be a market that opens after the New Year holiday and drops 700 points and basically says it's a signal to Congress, you got to get something done here. So we may be, that's kind of the way this Republican House and this Democratic White House have been operating for several years now. And I don't know why anybody thinks that the same players are going to behave any differently in this negotiation than they did in the summer of 2011.
And Congress is certainly paying a price in terms of the way the public feels about them and their public approval ratings. I think it's safe to say the American voters, American public, is not happy with this.
Yeah, that's right. I asked Congressman Camp this morning whether there's any self-awareness here of how this looks to those of us on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think on the outside, you know, it looks like it's a big game, and it, these caricatured figures are playing with monopoly money. But when in reality, I mean, they're playing with the financial future of the country. And one of the other points is I think you see a level of seriousness here that is focused mostly on the tactical politics of who's going to win, who's going to lose, who can, you know, do victory dances in the next couple of cycles and new cycles, as opposed to how are we going to get a path to solving these, some of these problems.
Well, from financial dealings in D.C., let's go to finances at Detroit's City Hall. That drumbeat is getting louder by the day, the march towards an emergency financial manager. And yesterday we got word Governor Snyder has appointed a review team to dive into Detroit's books. First of all, what does this exactly mean in the move towards an emergency financial manager?
Well, I think clearly he's trying to get bring some financial muscle and acumen to the table. I mean, one of them is a former head of Ford Credit. Ken Whipple, who's a very sharp guy, and Daryl Burks is a very sharp accountant. These guys have got real credibility in the financial community, and I think a financial manager is all but inevitable here. The irony of this is likely to happen. This 30-day clock is going to run out about the time that the world press descends on Detroit for the Detroit Auto Show.
So you're going to have
this real distinction between these auto companies that are making more money than they made in any of our lifetimes, juxtaposed against their hometown, which is on the verge of financial collapse and is likely to be taken over by the governor. I mean, I do think that it is highly likely that there will be an emergency financial manager. I think you can almost bet on it. And that then would be a pathway potentially to Chapter 9. I think what we really are going to have to see is how effective an emergency financial manager is in moving forward with some of the restructuring. I mean, whether or not there's going to be a Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing is going to really depend upon the success that this financial manager has with working with the mayor and with counsel in executing restructuring.
Reporting from Capitol Hill, it's been good talking with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. And meantime, happy holidays, Daniel.
Same to you, Cynthia.
Still to come, we continue our series on the homeless in Michigan. We'll meet a man helping Michiganders understand what it's really like to live without a roof over your head. That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Michigan made history by becoming the 24th right-to-work state, there was a group that did not find itself covered by the new law: police officers and firefighters. Just why did state lawmakers choose to exempt police and fire from right-to-work? Rick Hagland of Bridge Magazine looked into that question, and he joins us now. Hi, Rick.
Hello, Cynthia.
So what did you find out? Just why are police and fire exempt from right-to-work in Michigan?
Well, there are a number of reasons. The basic reason given was that police and firefighters have kind of a special recognition under state law called Public Act 312, which basically prevents firefighters and police officers from striking.
And that goes back a ways, doesn't it?
It does. It goes back to actually 1969, and the person who actually introduced the legislation was Coleman Young, who at that time was a state senator. And the reason that he did that was that the city, you know, back then many cities were experiencing police and firefighter strikes. You may remember they used to call it the blue flu.
I do.
And so there were lots of strikes and kind of disrupted operations. So the Public Act 312 basically said, okay, you can't strike anymore, but you get, in exchange for that, we will give you binding arbitration. And Coleman Young thought that this would be a good thing. He thought arbitrators would kind of limit the contract awards, but exactly the opposite has happened since then. So arbitrators in Detroit actually gave, you know, some pretty generous awards, which put the city in some kind of dire financial straits at the time.
So why did that exempt them?
Well, what happened was in order for police and firefighters to become part of the right to work law, lawmakers would have had to amend Public Act 312.
Got
they
it.
Chose not to do that for a variety of reasons. Some claim it was practical. Some claim it was political. And there's a bit of controversy about it.
And dig into that controversy for us, then. Who's upset by this? Who's saying it's political?
Well, people who are opposed to right to work are basically saying, hey, why did the police and firefighters unions get exempt from this? Why aren't they covered by right to work? The some are saying that this was sort of a reward by the Republicans for the police and firefighter unions to who basically sat out the debate over Proposal 2, which would have put collective bargaining rights in the Constitution. And so they're saying, well, you know, the Republicans gave them a little reward for that, for not working to put Proposal 2 in the Constitution.
And Rick, did you find any evidence that pointed to that?
We didn't. We didn't find any particular campaign contributions, one way or the other, in Proposal 2. One of the things I think we did find was that they basically did just kind of sit it out. They didn't get involved one way or the other on that.
How unique are these carve-outs for police and firefighters among the 24 right-to-work states?
Well, it turns out that Michigan is really the only state that does this, according to the National Right to Work Legal Defense Fund. That there are no other states, no other right-to-work states that do a carve-out for police and fire. Now, they may also not have the same law as Michigan in Public Act 312.
Now, you talked with Bill Ballinger for your story, who is, of course, a former lawmaker, and he publishes Inside Michigan Politics. In fact, he's been a guest here on Stateside. He made an interesting observation to you that I'd like you to get into a little bit. He said both Michigan Democrats and Michigan Republicans, quote, covet the support of the police and firefighter unions. It got me wondering, do you think that means the support of, let's say, the UAW is less important to them?
Well, I think not necessarily less important. I mean, the UAW, for instance, is a major financial backer. But, you know, in our society, we hold military personnel and first responders in very high esteem. And if you can run a TV ad showing, a local police or firefighter endorsing your campaign, particularly if the whole union is endorsing your campaign, that tends to mean a lot in the local races.
I wondered if it maybe said more about police or firefighters or more about perhaps declining power of the UAW. We certainly feel that the UAW, observers feel that the UAW's power was diminished after Right to Work passed.
That's true. I mean, the membership of the UAW is, you know, probably less than half of what it was at its peak in
right.
the late 1970s. It still has a lot of, financial clout. I mean, it can dump a lot of money into campaigns. Proposal 2 probably questioned how effective that is. Although, you know, there's another argument out there that says that the defeat of Proposal 2 kind of says less about unions than it does about the fact that, you know, you had six proposals on the ballot that voters, you know, to some degree maybe didn't understand or just were suspicious of. And when there's a lot of proposals on the ballot, people tend to vote them all down.
Kind of just a tidal wave of hands off the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
What are you hearing from other public sector unions, let's say teachers?
Well, they've been fairly, they've been kind of silent about this. I haven't really heard much from some of the other unions. You know, it's interesting, the police and fire unions are saying that, even though we're exempted from right to work, they're not crowing about the fact that they've got something that nobody else has got, from what I can see.
They're saying, really, you should look at other public sector unions as well and extend the same exemption to them.
Yes, and they'd prefer that there was no right to work law at all. There's also been one of the other unions that did not get an exemption. were the corrections officers unions, and they claim, hey, we do dangerous work just like the police and firefighters do, and we should have some special treatment.
And corrections officers, are they covered under Public Act 312?
They are not. Hmm. It's just police and firefighter unions. There's also another one that applies to state police troopers and sergeants. They actually have collective bargaining rights constitutionally protected. This goes back to 1978, where they, I believe they got a proposal on the ballot, and it passed, but they do have constitutionally protected collective bargaining rights.
Rick Hagelin from Bridge Magazine, looking into the exemption from right to work for police officers and firefighters. Thanks for talking with us, Rick.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
Here on Stateside, we introduce you to the acclaimed documentary Burn, 1 year on the front lines of the battle to save Detroit. We talked with filmmakers Brenna Sanchez and Tom Putnam and retired Detroit firefighter Dave Parnell. We spoke to them about what it took to make the film, including a big, big helping hand in the way of money from executive producer Dennis Leary and also from General Motors and a grassroots Kickstarter campaign. If you have ever wondered what's it like to run into that burning building when everyone else is running out, you will get the answer watching Burn. And you begin to get an idea of the sense of brotherhood between the firefighters and the challenges faced by firefighters across the country who try to fulfill their mission of saving lives and property, even as cash-strapped cities and townships cut budgets and hand out layoff notices. We wanted to explore that in more depth, so today we welcome two of the Detroit firefighters who are featured in Burn, both second-generation firemen and both born and raised on Detroit's East Side. Chris Palm and Tony Angelucci, welcome to Stateside. Tony, I'm going to start with you. How important was it to you to see this film come together and give the world some idea of your job?
At first, it was shocking to see what we do. You know, we're always doing it, so we don't get a chance to sit back and watch, and just seeing life taking chances that we take into going into these burning buildings, you know, and these roof collapses and everything else, these rescues.
Chris, does it feel very different watching? I get the sense, Tony, saying that it's different watching it than being in the middle of it.
Oh, absolutely. I think for most of us, if not all of us, you go into, when that alert goes off, you go into a different mode. We can go from joking around to, as soon as that alert goes off, it's serious. And when you get to the scene, if there's a fire and you just do your job, it's more of an instinct. And you just do it, and you do it good, and you get done, and you go home. And then to see it on film kind of makes you wonder, like, oh, why are we doing that type thing? But it puts it in a whole new perspective. Because, like I said, when you pull up on that scene, if you got smoke showing or flames showing, you go in a different mode, and to see it on film, it's a whole different point of view.
My late father was a fire captain, and I can remember even back in the 60s when I was a kid hearing him grumbling about things going on in our town when, for example, a contract would be up. And I remember he was especially, I think, as insulted as he was hurt that some woman said, well, you don't do anything anyway. You sit around and drink coffee. Do you think the public doesn't really get what it is you guys do?
I would say in Detroit, a lot of the public knows kind of what we do because they see it on a daily basis because there's so much fire in the city. After 9/11, firemen and cops and first responders, we were like top priority. Everyone loved us. They still do, but you don't see it as much now. And I think, and unfortunately for the brothers and sisters that we lost in 9/11, it's shocking to realize that the citizens and the politicians do not see what we do.
What are your thoughts on that, Tony, just with the world not really appreciating what it takes to do your job?
Well, they just don't see what we see. Just the arson, all the abandoned buildings that we see every day. When you make that 911 call, we are first on the scene, no matter what it is. You know, if it's a plane crash, a fire, an accident, it's just hard to see that, you know, and to believe that people think that that's all we do is just sit around. But we do community events, we do school events. We just don't sit around. We do have downtime, but that's very rare in Detroit.
I'm kind of wondering your thoughts, both of you. What do you think sets Byrne apart and above previous movies about firefighters. I'll toss out Backdraft and Ladder 49 as two fairly recent ones that come to mind. What do you think makes Byrne special, Chris?
It's the real deal. There's no props. It's the real fire, real smoke, real heat. In those other movies, they show the inside the fire, and it's like you're standing in a normal room. That is absolutely not how it is. Nothing was scripted. It was all real footage. And I think to get that and the way that we got it and how well Tom and Brenna put it together sets it apart from any other firefighter movie that has been made.
I think the helmet cams just are what make it so mind-blowing.
Yeah, the helmet cams are really take you into the fire with us and see what we see. You can't feel the heat, but you can almost see what we can see going into a fire. But that's just the beginning. Once we're into the fire, it just turns black, and you can't see nothing else. You just feel with your ears where you're going, try to find a fire.
As we were watching it, we were kind of getting a sense of, wow, I can only imagine what the smell is like and what that heat is like.
The heat is just, it's nothing like it in the world, the heat, where it's coming from. It's just unexplainable.
I'm speaking with firefighters Chris Palm and Tony Angelucci, Detroit firefighters, who are featured in the acclaimed documentary Byrne, 1 year on the front lines of the battle to save Detroit. I'm wondering, what could both of you tell us, or what do you remember about your first big run, major fire, when you were rookies? Was it excited? Was it scared? Do you remember it, Chris?
Oh, I was scared to death. Being that my dad was on the fire department and my older brother, the day before my first day going to the engine house, I asked him, hey, what, you got any advice or what can I expect my day? I just remember him looking at me and he just said, stay low. So actually my first day in the engine house, I was probably there about 15 minutes, and I caught my first fire. And on the way there, I'm going, oh, no, oh, no. And then we pulled up, and it was blowing out the upstairs window, and I had a really good boss with me. So he grabbed me and called me down and said, okay, let's go do it. He goes, I'm not going to go anywhere. You're not going to go anywhere. I'm not going to be, so let's go do it. And did it. Now it's no fire is the same, that's for sure, but you kind of get used to each guy. Each crew, I should say, has a routine when it comes to putting out a fire.
Tony, how about your first fire?
Yeah, my first fire, I was scared to death. You're told in the academy, your first fires, these are the two first fires you don't want to have, a basement fire or an attic fire.
Hmm.
And the luck of the draw was my first fire was an attic fire. So you're trying to go up the stairs with all this heat pushing down, you know, it's coming down the stairs because there's only one way in, one way out of an attic. And it was cooking up there. I was walking into an oven. But like Chris says, you have a boss with you, and you got to trust your life in his hands because he knows what's going on, and he's with you at all times. And you know, once you get up there, you put the fire out, and it's a sense of accomplishment that you're doing your job and you're learning at the same time.
But, and I would say the way we fight fires that we've been trained, there's technique involved. We just don't go running in and run right to the fire. I mean, we got the line, we open it up, we're sweeping the floor. A lot of the fire you listen for. Then you got your bosses and the other firefighters that are looking around, opening walls up, stuff like that. So it's a lot of technique. It's not like we're just jumping right into the middle of the fire. Fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, we have a lot of experience in the city. That's why I think our injury rate is down, but it's up right now because we're so short, but and we're doing so much.
The film focuses clearly on your group of firefighters in Detroit, but it really does speak to the struggles and challenges of firefighters and first responders all across the country in our current economy. It really hit me. I heard one of the guys in the film saying he'd been a firefighter for 21 years and in the last 11 years had gotten nothing in terms of a pay raise, and everybody has second jobs. And it got me wondering, what do you think that the general public really needs to understand and recognize about the men and women of the public employee unions who are these first responders? You guys, what does the public not get? I'll start with you, Chris.
I would say that every time we go to work or get a call, we're leaving our family behind. We go to work in the morning, and there's a great possibility that we might not be coming home. And we're gone. We miss birthdays and Christmas and holidays And we sacrifice a lot for the citizens. We love to do it. We love our job. That's why we're still doing it. It's definitely not doing it for the pay, that's for sure. Because if we were, we wouldn't be there.
Tony Angelucci and Chris Palm, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Burn is showing until Friday at AMC Theaters in Livonia and Sterling Heights. The filmmakers are still raising money to increase distribution, and part of the proceeds from Burn will go to the Leary Firefighters Foundation to buy equipment for Detroit firefighters. Find out more on the website, DetroitFireFilm.org, and we've put a link up on our website at MichiganRadio.org. Still to come. When was the last time you were in a big city, maybe visiting Chicago or visiting New York? Did you notice how easy it was to get around without a car? Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll look at why Michigan cities continue to be so far behind in mass transit. This is Stateside. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a very unusual game being played these days in Traverse City. It's not a game you're going to find at a toy store, and it's not particularly designed for, well, fun. It's called Home Sweet Homelessness. The man who developed this board game is a retired educator from the University of Detroit Mercy who now lives in Traverse City, and he joins us now from Traverse City. John Daniels, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, Cynthia. Good to be with you.
Well, exactly what is Home Sweet Homelessness?
It's a simulator. I volunteer at Goodwill Inn here, which is a shelter, and when I brought what I learned at U of D Mercy and leadership development in terms of exercises, I found that these people were as bright as my honor students, and I was surprised, and I wanted them to realize how good they were, so I gave them a stretch goal, and that was challenging them to design a simulation game for those of us who have never been homeless, so when we play the game, we begin to experience it.
So give us an idea, John Daniels, of the kinds of challenges and experiences and scenarios that we might get presented by as players.
The game starts in the center of the board, halfway up. If you think of chutes and ladders, you start at the bottom and you want to get all the way to the top. But most of us start in the middle. We move in with roommates and we want to get our own place because they're driving us crazy. And we want to get our own home so we don't waste our equity and things like that. But with so many people, it ends up being a shelter or couch surfing or, God knows, sleeping on the street. And so the kinds of things that would happen would be very close to the top. You know, the player is really getting excited because they're almost to home sweet home. Death of the breadwinner. Go back down to space 23, which is couch surfing with your friends. Mm. You're moving in with your family. You're hoping they don't get sick of you being around. The company downsizes and moves out of the state.
It's such an easy tendency to think of them and us, the haves, the have-nots, and kind of just, yes, have that assumption. Well, they're choosing this, or they've done something wrong, or I gather your hope is to narrow that gap.
Exactly. And it's hard for us to relate to homeless people, like it is with any person who's different, has a different history than us. Mm-hmm. And so when they developed the game as a simulator for us, they said, okay, we're ready to try this out. Who are you going to bring in? And so I needed some people who hadn't experienced homelessness. And the Goodwill Inn executives were the first people, and they brought in some other leaders in Traverse City here. What I was hoping for was that the people who played the game would find the game wonderful. But what we found was that the interplay between, I call them the game guides, the designers who designed the game, the homeless people and the non-homeless people, the interaction between them was what was the real magic in the game.
Well, what kinds of interaction did you see? What excited you?
One of the elements of the game is a question card. There's question marks all over the board. Of the 90 spaces, there's probably 15 that have question marks. And when you have a question mark, you have to pick up a card and answer it. And these were designed by the homeless people so that we would have to get into their shoes And there's one, and I'm going to get choked up a little because remembering the experience of the guy who read it. This is a businessman who gets this, and he looks at the card,
yeah,
and he says, "You've had a loyal dog for 12 years. The shelter will take you in. What will you do with the dog?" And so here's this guy starting to, and you can't answer it on that turn. You have to go around and then answer it on your next turn. So everybody knows what you've got,
yeah,
and they're kind of wondering what you're going to say. So the people who came to the game, number one, began to say, oh, my God, I never thought of that. That's music to my ears. Oh, my God, I never thought of that.
So a tremendous empathy lesson.
Yeah.
What did you learn, John, in the process of putting this all together and working with the game guides?
I think that the humanity of everybody at that table is the same. When we bring people together, the game provides a comfortable place for people who are very different from each other to play and to learn with each other. And the result is that their humanity isn't held back. Mm-hmm. It's not bottled up because it's not appropriate. And I went into it hoping that the game would provide something that we could use in rotating shelters and parishes with poverty programs, in schools where homeless kids and non-homeless kids share classrooms, something that can help people get past, I don't know what to say, or I don't think they'll understand. And I guess what I've learned is it works.
John Daniels worked with homeless residents of a shelter in Traverse City, developing a game called Home Sweet Homelessness, the housing reality game that will open your eyes. John Daniels, thanks for speaking with us today.
Cynthia, thank you.
It hits you whenever you visit Chicago or Toronto or New York, Washington, how you're able to get around the city without a car, without having to fork over big bucks for downtown parking, all for the price of a subway or a bus ticket. And then you come home to Michigan's major cities, where a subway system's but a dream, and buses may or may not roll up and be able to get you to where you want to go. The Southeast Michigan region didn't even have an authority, a regional authority, until very recently when the lame duck legislature passed Senate Bill 909 and created a Southeast Michigan Regional Transit Authority. This includes Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Washtenaw counties, and the new transportation authority will be overseen by a 10-member appointed board. But still, why is Michigan so far behind when it comes to mass transit? Adi Tamer is a senior research associate at the Brookings Institution, a Washington-based think tank, and he joins us now. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So just why are Michigan's major cities lagging so far behind other states when it comes to effective mass transit?
Yeah, Michigan, of course, has a legacy of essentially, not necessarily underinvestment in public transportation, but a clear prioritization over personal highway infrastructure investments over those for more mass transit expenditures. And in many ways, this makes sense. Of course, I don't need to tell your listeners about the role of the auto industry in Michigan's past and all the great benefits, frankly, it gave to households who had jobs in it and selling the cars all over the world. But one of the consequences of building out so many highways, whether we're talking about Detroit or Grand Rapids, is a underinvestment relative to those highway miles for public transportation, for those who may choose to not own a vehicle or simply are more interested in maybe leaving their car parked in the driveway and traveling to work through buses or even the potential for rail. In many ways, this left Detroit, which is one of the largest metropolitan areas in the country, as really one of those few at the top, if you will, there, without a major mass transportation system specifically that helped interlink its city and suburbs.
Well, in fact, I'll even date myself. I can remember my father taking me down to make sure that I got a ride. I was a little one, but I got a ride on the streetcar going up and down Woodward Avenue just as they were closing it down, which was in the 50s. And I guess that's kind of what we're talking about, wasn't it? Because the car makers were much happier seeing us all in cars rather than riding streetcars.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a kind of well-trodden tale in the transportation circles about the role that was played by certain firms, and many say complicit in the national government too, to allow those streetcar tracks to be ripped out all across the country. And really, actually, not just not just promoting automobile travel, but actually disincentivizing travel by the rails, especially these kind of local inner-city routes that we had built up, not just necessarily in Detroit, again, also places like Los Angeles and Washington, right here in Washington, D.C., where I am. So what we're seeing these days is really a reversal of that trend, a back-to-the-future kind of investment mentality of trying to create more options for Americans to get around. And in many ways, the fiscal crisis in 2008 kind of really helped bring this home. You know, for example, in the Detroit metropolitan area, we have seen that there are over 130,000 families without a vehicle. And that number obviously went up once the financial crisis hit. And the question is, how can we make sure that they have options to get around? Again, as well as those other families that maybe have a car or even two, but you know, want to have options when it comes to getting to work or going to the grocery store, et cetera.
That leads me to kind of wonder what your thoughts are in the price that, you know, we as citizens pay in terms of quality of life or job opportunities by not having effective mass transit in our big cities.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. And it's one, again, I think some of the, especially the largest metropolitan areas where people face long commutes or just frankly long distances between places are really starting to think through is, you know, what is kind of having only one option do for me? You know, number one is that we see, you know, people are forced to spend more on gas, which in the long run has been going up in price. And even with the change to, you know, liquefied natural gas that we're seeing in the United States, even if we are an energy exporter, we're still going to need to import petroleum for specifically our automobiles. So that kind of cost really can't be exchanged for something else when it comes to, you know, when we're limited in our transportation options. Of course, cars also pollute at a higher rate than buses and trains, certainly when those buses and trains are full. And also, you know, cars are simply such an active experience, especially for the driver, whereas, you know, taking a seat on a bus or a train really offers the opportunities to be productive in other ways, whether it means reading a magazine or even catching up on work email.
Or sleep.
And so there's a real difference there that people are starting to get keen to.
Yes. And I see that, as I say, I just came back from visiting my son, daughter-in-law, and grandson in Chicago, and it is stunning how they just automatically assume that they can each get to work, get home, get around. If it's not on foot, then you catch the L. And it's just become such a part of their life. And it makes me, when I look at that, wonder, could we ever really see that here in Michigan? If we could see it in Grand Rapids, see it in Detroit. And I know we've begun with this, with our new Transportation Authority for Southeast Michigan, but that's just a group of people. And you wonder, will it ever happen?
You know, the one big thing that we found, we did a big study a couple of years ago on public transportation in America comparing the 100 largest metropolitan areas of which Detroit and Grand Rapids are each a part of. And what we found from Detroit was that actually buses tend to run fairly well in terms of neighborhood coverage. You know, they tend to, most people live in a neighborhood with service. And actually the buses run pretty frequently, especially in the city of Detroit. It's about a 7.5 average wait time for a bus. The problem arises from Detroit is simply so spread out now. So there are so many jobs and people in the suburbs and then vice versa in the city. And frankly, the distances to travel and the need to go to these central depot locations has really created problems when it comes to commuting. The question is, will this now regional transportation authority give local leaders the opportunity to make planning more aligned with where people have chosen to live and where jobs have located over the past few decades? So more suburb-to-suburb routing, maybe more frequent routing along certain main corridors, as you brought up. You know, what are they going to do with the Woodward Avenue line to help make it a more attractive location for businesses and people, you know, to move to that area? The bones are there, but a lot of tough decisions are ahead of them.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Adi Tumer, who's a senior research associate at the Brookings Institute, Washington-based think tank, looking at the future of mass transit in Michigan. Now, we've been talking about Detroit. What can we address as far as Grand Rapids, because they were a part of your study as well?
Yeah, so the service connectivity is actually quite good. One of the top, what we call transportation accessibility metrics in the country. And what that means is, if I live in neighborhood X, you know, how many jobs can I get to throughout the rest of my metropolitan area? And again, Grand Rapids actually does quite a good job there.
Detroit's issue, too, we have to talk about the cash problems, because there are many riders with stories of standing and waiting, and a bus doesn't come and a bus doesn't come. And basically it's because it's broken down and it's sitting in a warehouse, you know, in a maintenance garage, and they can't get them fixed. Do you envision a day when Detroit would be able to, with the help of this regional authority, be able to kind of get things more on track?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much that can happen from having this kind of regional governance structure in place now. Number one is, depending on how they structure it, but if there's a willingness on the part of the residents, Michigan has some unique state laws with regards to the millages and things for what regional authorities in transportation can raise. But, you know, if the residents are willing to kind of pay for it, there's an opportunity now to make some of these investments.
Meaning say yes to tax increases.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially essentially what we're talking about. What we're seeing across the country is that even though there are obviously different sides of the aisle, but when it comes to taxes, let's say, of course, the fiscal cliff negotiations going on right now in Washington, there seems to be a question mark, right, over if we're going to see taxes increase. What do I, you know, as a taxpayer, get for my money?
Yeah, yeah.
But what we've seen across the country actually is the opposite in terms of attitude when it comes to local transportation issues, and not just buses and trains, but also highways, too. From across the country, metropolitan areas are passing these local ballot measures to tax themselves a little bit more to be able to get more local transportation dollars, essentially shouting out, you know, for other communities to say, look, if you can tell me where my money's going to go, I have more willingness to invest in these kind of public utilities. There's a great opportunity here in Detroit, again, but it's a question of how can the public, private, and citizen work together to make it a reality.
Adi, I know in your studies you point to Portland as kind of the golden child of mass transit. What lessons can Grand Rapids and Detroit and our other large cities in Michigan learn from Portland?
Yeah, you know, Portland is many ways in vogue in the United States. They've kind of set themselves up for decades now from a planning perspective to say we want to change our identity for how people commute. And so they've instituted a few things. Number one is, again, they also are willing to tax themselves to build certain public transportation infrastructure that, frankly, the citizens were interested in. Everything from streetcars to light rails, even to bike infrastructure that really could give their citizens options. But on the other side of the planning equation, they've also been very purposeful about where real estate development is going to occur. And it's trying to concentrate development in specific nodes to make sure that distances are tighter, and people can have more options in the kind of physical environment they can live in. This isn't about, quote-unquote, outlawing the suburbs, which, you know, sometimes critics kind of see for places like Portland. In fact, it's Portland has just as many suburbs as other places. But it's also providing neighborhoods that are denser, that are more, quote-unquote, walkable, also bikeable, if you will, and give people the options to live in those places, or even, frankly, for businesses to locate in those places. So, in many ways, this is so much of what local leaders are trying to do with the Woodward Avenue line is create that kind of environment right there in Detroit. You know, Detroit has such great bones in the dense kind of central business district, you know, a great street grid, the opportunity to really have this kind of dense environment. It's now time for public transportation to kind of help bring that home to, again, give more options for the residents in the greater metropolitan area.
Almost, as you say, going kind of back to the future, going back to the way it was in the 40s when you did have a dense business area and people could get to it and get to it easily.
Yeah, we made a great big experiment when it came to the automobile. For decades, we decided from, you know, the federal government down to local levels that we were really going to invest in the automobile. Everyone was going to have an opportunity to own a car, and we really tried out that kind of exclusive model. But what we've kind of learned, which is true almost in any public policy you pick, that investing in just one thing tends to not work. Moderation in kind of a more central road tends to be more effective. And by ignoring especially public transportation options, but also, you know, this unexpected effect of creating environments that weren't walkable, that weren't bikeable, has left us with less options. And frankly, people are starting to be interested in some of those alternatives. Again, it's not about getting rid of, you know, more auto-centric suburbs, let's say. It's about having choice, you know, in your neighborhood. And frankly, what's more American than that?
Adi Tomer with the Brookings Institute. Thanks for your insights and thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
All right. Thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from you. What ideas do you have for mass transit in Michigan? What would you like to see? Let us know. Find us on Facebook at Stateside with Cynthia Canty or on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Let's talk tomorrow at 3 o'clock.